Hey everyone, this is Connor. Before we get started, I just want to encourage you to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/podsidepicnic. If you become a patron, you'll get access to multiple exclusive episodes every month. And you can also join our patrons-only Discord chat, where Pete and I talk informally with the Podside Picnic community. So if you like the show, go ahead and check us out at patreon.com/podsidepicnic. Thanks.
Welcome back to Podside, everyone. This is Carlo. It's me and Chris. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Carlo. I'm doing good.
And today we're going to be talking about a movie made a while back. So we know what the synopsis is. You know, this is Silent Running, 1972. Mm-hmm. This is our second. This rounds out the Douglas Trumbull oeuvre. And you know what? I feel like this is. I could probably summarize the. The film rather easily, right? You know?
Yeah.
In the not too distant future, 20 something AD, there was a guy named Lowell.
Oh.
Yeah. Not too different than you or me.
Yeah.
He worked in the ship's forestry service gardens. Yeah, well, you know, and they killed his coworkers and made his three robot friends.
Yeah, so I actually do think that. So this was originally how I watched this, because I think Joel Hodgson has said that this was partly an inspiration for, among a million other things, but partly an inspiration for Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah.
So very astute.
It sort of stuck out at me, and I'm joking a little bit about it, but it is really like, I think that this, we could get into it in a bit, but mm-hmm. I will say that there is a lot of things that, to sympathize with, like a lot of sort of feelings that probably were happening in 72 mm-hmm. that you can still sort of sympathize with, even though I'm not entirely sure they work the way they would have at the time anymore, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
But I can definitely see, like, there is a certain feeling to this movie. Again, I think it's very sincere in the way in sort of a, I hesitate to say it this way, but it's sort of like this very, this is going to sound mean, but it's almost like a dopey sentimentality to it.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a knock, but it I think it just stems from the fact that this was made in a completely different time, and where there were like still some ideas as to how technology could get us out of a bind.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's there, right?
I totally understand exactly where you're coming from, but I also still think that there is still a little bit of a cynical edge to it. Mm-hmm. enough that I think it's still, that makes it still relevant today, and not just a kind of like, you know, blindingly, you know, willfully blind optimistic view, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean I do think that at the end it's a weirdly, we can get into it, but I do think that at the end it does offer this weird defiance that nevertheless has like this almost fatalistic hope to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But let's start at the beginning, right? Because
let's do it.
Essentially we find out that I guess due to nuclear war and or just pollution, just rampant pollution, mm-hmm. that they've launched these like Battlestar Galactica style. They've launched like these a handful. I couldn't even really see how many. I don't remember right now, but it's a variety, like several different ships that have within them. They're sort of manned by a very small skeleton crew, I guess, foreseeing how transportation would be in our day and age. It's manned by like three or four guys, each one of these gigantic ships. And each one of them has like three attached to them, like three detachable domes that have like a forest encased inside of them. Cool, like visuals. I gotta admit.
Yeah, it's got biodomes all over. It's this giant, like, container type ship, and it has, you know, these giant glass domes kind of like popping up all around it. It's very cool. I like the idea of like the and there's you mentioned the crew. This kind of beat Alien to the whole, like, you know, like truck drivers in space type of aesthetic.
Yeah, they definitely come across as like just guys that are doing a job.
Yeah, we first meet them all when they're kind of just like horsing around on like dune buggies, basically. Like, they're just like
it's such a funny thing. Like, you know that if it was made today, which it wouldn't be, but if it was remade today, those would be alt ATVs or something.
Yes, or I guess the big thing now is side by sides, which are the like little, like tiny little mini, they look like golf carts, but they're like off-road golf carts.
Weird. I don't think I've seen these.
That's apparently been the new popular, you have to start driving in more rural areas there, Carlo.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. But it has that kind of like, you know, grimy, like, you know, stuff is like futuristic, but not shiny and plasticky, like, you know, we're typically seeing like it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you mentioned Douglas Trumbull directed this, and he's also, you know, obviously one of the great effects and designers. And, you know, he probably brings this is not too long after his work on 2001. So, well,
I think that was something I read that he wanted specifically in 2001. One of the things that is in, I think we were talking a little bit about this offline, but not this specifically, just 2001. And I think you had an interesting point that we can get to in a second.
Yeah.
But one of the things that struck me is that apparently he did work in 2001 in the novelization of the movie. And it's hard to say which came first, in part because they were sort of developed in tandem. Mm-hmm. But in the novelization, the ship ends up like the Stargate, the giant monolith with the Stargate in it is essentially hanging suspended in space around Saturn, in orbit around Saturn and not Jupiter, as it ended up being in the movie. And here we actually do get like, it looks like what they did was that they had like the like inside the dome was like a set, and outside of the quote panes of the geodesic dome, you can see, it looks like they've projected Saturn on a screen somewhere. But it's a perfectly fine effect. I think it works perfectly fine. But you can tell just simply because of the gap in time and technology, you know, like you could tell even myself, who I'm a complete noob. you are like a PhD in comparison to me, Chris.
Well, no, but yeah, I think there's a lot of connections with 2001. And that was even, you know, there's this, the Douglas, obviously the Douglas Trumbull. I think this, a movie like this wouldn't have even existed had 2001 not, you know, existed itself, because, you know, that, and I'm fascinated by the 2001, not just as, you know, a work on itself, but also I think I mentioned before, but I'm reading a book on the making of it. And I've definitely mentioned it offline, but like, there, you know, it's considered, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but for the large list, but let's just go with it for the sake of this argument. It's kind of like the first, like, science fiction movie that was really taken genuinely seriously, a very Hollywood. Let me caveat that with saying Hollywood movie, Hollywood science fiction movie that was like really taken genuinely seriously. And I feel like had that not been successful or not as like the masterpiece it is, we wouldn't be getting movies like Silent Running. So I think it definitely is. It owes a debt to 2001 in that aspect. Well, yeah.
I will say, and I think that this is something that this is tangential, not directly related, but it is something that I was reading in the new magazine called, I don't know if you heard about this one, Type Bar. I had something come out in there, but one of the other articles, which is about the dying sun in mm-hmm. in like sort of like early 20th century or even late 19th century, early 20th century science fiction and fantasy works, there's this fixation on the sun dying. Mm. And it turns out that at the time, the science just that no one knew exactly how the sun emitted like light, mm-hmm. like radiated light. Mm-hmm. So everyone had like these ideas. And obviously, as things are wont to happen, people started obsessing about like, well, the sun will die out at any moment, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. The reason I mention this is because the science fiction and fantasy of the time were following the science of the time. Mm. And I want to point out that I would argue that 2001, A Space Odyssey, coming out in 1968, would probably not have been taken as seriously if the U.S. had not currently been, at that point in time, had called its moonshot, if you will, right?
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
And so this starts to mesh with the sort of like the zeitgeist at the time of people thinking about, well, what would being in space look like?
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, you had pointed out that this even like you pointed out was it an Italian?
Yeah. So Italy is notorious for retitling movies and like passing them off as related to other like franchises.
Folks, it's not just the Ghanaian movie posters.
Yeah. But apparently Silent Running was retitled in Italian 2002, The Next Odyssey or The Second Odyssey.
Because why not?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Honestly, I think that if that affected their box office, bully to them. That's
yeah, exactly you
know, excellent work. I do want to point out that the ships also look very much like that long, sort of almost girder-like look that the ship in 2001 has.
Mm-hmm.
All of these like look, at least the models do. As I understand it, the interiors were, and it's referenced in the names in the movie itself. The interiors apparently were filmed on the USS Valley Forge, which was a, what is this, LPH? I'm not even sure. Like a precursor or an older aircraft carrier that was docked at Long Beach Naval Shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the interiors, also I'm wondering how they felt about like, yeah, we're just going to bring in a bunch of mulch and potted like bagged earth to throw around in the corners to make it look like a, because like once they do the, I did find it funny that the interiors of the biodomes, they look very small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're like, well, this forest is like, it's missing a lot of stuff, I think.
Yeah. So, and it's also interesting. I don't know if you caught it because it kind of goes by it. But when you do see an outside shot of the ship, the Valley Forge, apparently the different ships have like fauna from like a specific area of the world.
I figured that was the case, but I wasn't absolutely certain.
Yeah. The other one, the one on the Valley Forge is from the Bahia Honda subtropical area, which is like apparently within the Florida Keys.
Hmm.
But I don't know if I saw any like palm trees or anything within, so I don't know how seriously they took that like kind of like world building.
There weren't any alligators in there.
Yeah, that's true.
And unless Lowell himself, like also let's point out the main character played by Bruce Dern,
who the great Bruce Dern.
Yes, and who in the marquee poster that is like on the internet now. I don't know if that's the original one, but I was like looking at him. I was like, why does he look like Ryan Ryan Reynolds, what the hell?
Oh. Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, it's not me, right? It's, he does
no, I see it. I
bear
see
a resemblance.
It.
But anyway, I love that his name is, because in science fiction, folks, names have to mean stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Freeman Lowell.
Yeah.
I also dig that he's like Space Jesus.
Yeah.
Although I will say that it's weird because he is sort of like dressed in these almost like monastic robes, but like a like off white or, you know, eggshell white or something like that. Not the brown ones that, you know, we would associate with, like, I don't know what, whatever they are, Franciscans or whatever.
Right.
But you know, with a rope belt and everything, the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because it definitely, like, you know, puts him in comparison to the other three guys who were on the ship with him, who, as we said, kind of just, you know, they're dudes, and they're, like, you know, all in, like, color coordinated jumpsuits, and they're just kind of like just doing their job. But he instantly is clear that he's, like, he's the one who actually, you know, cares about the plants and taking care of everything.
Yeah, he's the one that stands apart. Is mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so it is sort of funny because there is a lot of I felt like I joked about it, but I do think that there's a lot of, like, that strange like 70s era confluence of, like, hippie, like, crunchy granola hippie culture with, like, vague Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Which, you know, isn't great if you're not Christian, but
yeah,
it was everywhere. So I don't think that, like, I don't think that Trumbull is using it in sort of utilizing that in a way to, like, send a message. He just sort of, like, was picking up on, like, this is also, like, Lowell is in fact very much like an ecology guy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, like you said, I don't think this movie is making any sort of, you know, religious or theological statement at all. But like you said, it's kind of just picking up those general vibes that were out there in that era. Like, you know, this is like less than 4 years after, you know, 1969. So it's like that whole scene, and there is, like, legendary, like, you know, there was recently a movie about it, but there was a church in, like, Southern California that was, like, exclusively aimed towards hippies and stuff like that, bringing in like young hippies and things like that. Actually, and I don't know if it's the same place, but J. Michael Straczynski and his autobiography, rather, he talks about, like, basically, like, going along to one, like, a hippie church to meet women. But
I mean, as one does, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, yeah, like, I think it's an interesting confluence.
Mm-hmm.
And by 72, I feel like the promises, like, I think that we're seeing sort of where, like, the popular culture that was, you know, left leaning in any way, shape, or form was still sort of reeling from that, like, hangover of what might have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what might have changed if, you know,
yeah,
you know, certain things had zigged instead of zagged or whatever.
Oh yeah, it's very much that, you know, that Hunter S. Thompson speech about, like, you know, you could see where the wave crested and rolled back, and it's very much still living in that kind of hangover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so, like, part of the thing here, and it's not really ever spelled out, because you only get, like, glimpses of the, quote, outside world. In this case, it's mostly Earth. Mm-hmm. Through, like, you know, one way, like, not one way, but transmission. So it's, like, just narrowed down to, like, whatever you get. And one of the things that happens early on, like, you were talking about horsing around, mm-hmm. and the guys just go tearing through, like, he's, like, busy planting these little flowers, mm-hmm. and trying to, like, you know, like, straighten up like a plant that's been bent or whatever. And they just like, they're like just four wheeling through the same place he just finished doing. So like he has like a confrontation with the guys, and that sort of sets the tone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
where he stands apart from them. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He can join them on poker night, but he's not truly like one of them.
And weirdly, he is amazingly good at poker.
Yeah.
I mean, but think of it, because it's a, I feel like in a more sort of modern and quote trope aware type of movie, right? He would be the one losing all the time, because he's not connected to humanity.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and poker, so much of poker is reading the other players.
Yes. And because that in a more in a modern one, because he's just out of touch with humanity because he's connected with the ecology. And here it's almost like because he is connected to the ecology, he can read all these dummies like a book.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he cleans them out too. And this is like more or less, just to sort of show like the dynamic and everything like that. And not long after that, they get the orders that they have been sort of like in a holding pattern. Just to clarify, they've been in a holding pattern, just sort of like, because supposedly these ships are the biodomes that they're taking care of are like an extension of like the forestry service. Lowell has a bunch, like in his flight suit, has a bunch of like, he has like a patch with like the old patch with the old Smokey the Bear design and all that good stuff. And it's obvious that he's the guy that's really in charge of the dome, and the other guys are just sort of like truckers, right?
And in fact, like there's I like this bit of design where there's you kind of see the cargo that they're hauling along with like these biodome things, and they're like these giant stacks of white plastic something, but they have
dodecahedrons.
Yes, they look
like 12-sided, like gigantic, instead of like the regular containers that we would use like on 18-wheelers and stuff.
Yeah,
they look like 12-sided die.
Yes, exactly right. And but they have logos on them, like one was like Coca-Cola and other things, and like and even the ships are American Airlines freighters.
Oh,
like,
that's right. Yeah. Everything's been super corporatized. Yeah.
Exactly. So even though, and I think it does a good job of setting the table, which this new order kind of really underlines, is that even though they set off on this like grand ecological journey, it's still being underwritten by capitalism, you know?
Yeah. And the order is essentially they can come home. But as part of coming home, they're told, oh, you know what? You can just disengage all the domes and nuke them.
Yes.
Which I found to be like, wow, that's a little on the nose. But then you go like, wait, hold on. No, I think that would be just as absurd. It would happen just as absurdly in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other ship being, they get the orders from the other ship being the Berkshire. I think they're all the ships are named after like national parks, which kind of furthers this like ecological.
I believe it. Yep.
Conservation,
Yeah, I believe that was also part of, it's sort of like threaded in there, but it's not like, again, it's not hammered home.
Yeah, because it's not like Yosemite. It's it's some of the lesser known ones. Like it's like there's some of the other ones are Sequoia.
Yeah, that's right.
There is a Yellowstone that is mentioned. There's Acadia, Blue Ridge, Glacier, and Mojave. So it's like all very ecological. But anyway, yeah. So they get this. The blowing up with the nukes. It is a strange aspect to them, and it doesn't quite, they don't say why in the movie, but I mean, like, you can hazard a guess, but it is a little bit of a it seems like, rubbing salt in the wound type of thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was more or less what I thought as well, but also like, so this is one of the first instances where we get like, what looks like something that we might recognize as a critique of capitalism, but I feel like it gets too wound up in sort of like the movement at the time, like the pure food movement type of thing, right? Because like they have this big discussion about like how all the other guys, like they're making fun of Lowell because he essentially like picks stuff out of the domes. He harvests whatever he grows there. And like, he's always like eating cantaloupes and, you know, whatever he, it's generally cantaloupes because I guess that's what the budget could afford. But, but in general, we're supposed to imagine that he's eating other things, you know, like other crops and things that he's grown in the domes, because he's using them as gardens as well as everything else. And so the guys, the other guys are just eating like this pre-made crap. Like protein cubes or whatever the fuck they are exactly, which you can just sort of like stick in the microwave and they're ready in a couple of minutes and you eat it. And it's, you know, they're arguing back and forth like, yeah, it's, you know, it sustains us, you know, it tastes okay. And his, instead of being, see, this is where the critique would have tied it up in a neat little bow for me, at least, is that if the critique had been like, yeah, but think about it, you could grow your own stuff and not have to depend on this stuff. When you get back, they're going to ask you to buy it. And then, you know, then you put into sort of like a political discussion, like the idea that the environment, you know, sure, yeah, it shouldn't necessarily, it has value in and of itself. But one of the values is also that, yeah, you could sort of grow your own shit without having to buy stuff.
Yeah,
like it there's a reason that we can live on Earth in part because Earth is where we developed, and more or less all the aspects of what we need to live are already here.
Yeah.
freely given by the planet if we can take care of it,
right? Exactly.
But instead the argument is not that. It's an argument about like, well, this is not natural crap. You're putting a bunch of, you know, like essentially it's like you're putting a bunch of junk into your body, which, you know, doesn't age well. Because I mean, that's the argument that, you know, a-holes like the Liver King and these weird all meat diet assholes have as well. Right.
Right. You exactly.
You're putting the wrong food into your body.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that that's where it sort of stumbles a little bit, because it gets a little too far into like the sort of like the feeling of the moment. But again, I don't know that that's a wrong decision. I think it's done with intentionality, but I feel that it's not really the argument that I would have made is well, what I'm saying.
And I think the other thing is, though, I don't think we're supposed to think that everything Lowell does is correct, you know, or that he's like always morally righteous, you know. And so I think that's kind of, you know, part of going along with these kind of movements is there might be some aspects that aren't really consequential to the main thrust, but there's always these kind of like side things, like the, you know, the organic
implications.
Yes, exactly.
So essentially, he's trying, like, this is the part of the movie where they spend like a good time. Like, he tries to convince them that they don't need to just follow orders. But honestly, like you said, like, Lowell comes off as a little too, you sympathize with his point of view, but at the same time, he's just not able to let go the fact that, or maybe just understand that the guys that he's with are just tired.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, they just want to go back.
That's the thing. Like they're even the one guy's kind of like sympathetic, but he's just like, we just want to get home. Like they just, that's all they want to do.
Yeah. Because I mean, it's three or four guys. They're probably sick to death of each other. Yeah, they want to spend time with other people. It's isolation, you know. Like,
yeah.
I think that this is something that the movie does portray rather well. Once, you know, like Lowell decides to break with the orders, right?
Right. Exactly.
And break with the orders he does.
Indeed.
Rather vehemently, shall we say.
Yeah.
And again, I think that this is weird because initially we get to see Lowell as like a Jesus Christ figure when he shows up on screen. But when push comes to shove and the guys say, yeah, we're going to fucking do it, he manages to save one of the domes.
Mm-hmm.
But that is because he murders the guy that is planting the nuclear device into it.
Yes, exactly.
and it struck me because for a minute there, I thought he was going to, like Trumbull was going to really sort of like underline it by leaving, I don't know, like an animal jawbone around, because this is very much like Cain and Abel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Clear. Yes, absolutely.
And including the consequences of it, right? Like mm-hmm. this is essentially saying that, you know, he's going to the land of Space Nod.
Yeah.
Because he's, I mean, it is sort of self-exile as well, right? He did the thing that he thought was correct.
Right.
But, you know, he had to kill one of his coworkers, and then like he's just sort of like, he's so lonely that he decides to reprogram the drones. I did not know this. I suspected it, but I did not know. Did you know that the little robots are mm-hmm. were like inhabited by, like, I think the it's bilateral amputees?
Oh, so they're people who are missing their legs?
I believe. Let me make
sure.
So
they're walking on their like hands,
on their hands or something. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
If it's something that I just because of the movements of the little legs,
mm-hmm.
they seemed too fluid, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And what it brought to mind is exactly that. Like when somebody's doing like a hand, like one of those squat handstands, and they can start like sort of like moving around on their hands that way. It felt very much like that.
Well, and so they have these like three little like service drones, and they're kind of like upside down U shaped, and they have like these like little legs that stick out, and that's what they walk on, and in killing the guy, Lowell gets injured, so like one of his first orders of business is reprogramming the drones to come and like do surgery on his leg.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Cause yeah, like he manages to kill the dude with like his shovel.
Mm-hmm.
But not before dude like grabs the shovel out of his hands and just wails on his leg with the spade blade itself or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Cut him rather deeply mm-hmm. from what we can see. And like right. you said, yeah, like he reprograms like the little cards that it's almost like cartridges with circuits sticking out of them. It's very, very cool design, I got to admit.
It is cool. And I like the thing he was using to do it, because he was like not just like reprogramming in like a software sense, but he was like physically changing the chips. So he had this like giant microscope thing that he would use to, do that with. And that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that we get in Brainstorm as well. Like our previous episode on Brainstorm mm-hmm. is in fact like that sort of like that chunkiness of the technology is shown on screen. And it's something that I wish we'd get more of.
Right. Yeah. It really lends a more realistic sense of it. Like And not only that, but like how tech was at that time, like it mm-hmm. wasn't, yeah, like or where they thought it would be going.
Yeah, because if you'll notice, like the little cartridge design, mm-hmm. Where you just sort of like plug it into them, and I guess that just rejiggers their circuitry or whatever. It bears a very close resemblance to the way you remember the punch cards mm-hmm. for older computers. It just has that feeling to it that we don't get anymore, in part because like essentially all of our devices now are generally mirrored somewhere else in a data center.
Right.
So what you end up getting is what the server is streaming directly to you through your connection.
Right, right.
Again, I think this is, if Kurt were around, he'd probably talk about, like, this is how it used to be, an offline computer nerd used to be. but it is, I mean, it's a point that's, well observed, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, like I did rather like that, because you get to see, like, him sort of like doing something, and he starts to, like, he essentially does make himself some robot friends, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he does. Yeah, he, like, programs them to be a little bit more like, yeah, like friends, basically, like you said, like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but I know that we joked about it right at the top, but you could definitely see, like, the, you know, one of the stronger through lines of MST3K was probably this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at the very least, the very surface aesthetic of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A dude alone on a space station and his only company is his three robot friends.
Yes. We should also mention that he names the three robot friends Huey, Dewey, and Louie.
Yep.
And thankfully, I'm going to guess that because he didn't call them ducks, the Disney Corporation could not come after her. it was a reference with a wink.
That's right.
But yeah, like I did like how sort of it's almost, they're not cute in like the same way that a Wall-E or a BB-8, for instance, is.
Mm-hmm.
But they do, you could see the trajectory, like these are sort of like cutesy robot companions.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And they don't talk, you know, there's no, like you said, like they're not as anthropomorphized as a lot of these kind of characters typically are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thankfully they didn't try to make them talk. I mean, could you imagine, like,
yeah, that would,
they would just sound like speaking spells.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chris, have you ever heard a scream of terror that's monotone? Oh no, he's afraid. We've made a horrible mistake. We've taught this robot fear. But yeah, so a lot of the, like, there's a large chunk of the movie that is him slowly, like, just unraveling.
Yeah. Well, first he has to, like, fake an explosion, and that, like, and then that sets him off course. And so he's talking to, like, the Berkshire as they go off, and, like, he starts going through Saturn's rings, and they think they're gonna, like, lose him forever. And
I thought so maybe I'm off base, but what I thought had happened was that he was using essentially the dark side of the planet, to basically cut off communication, so that he and because he could then claim that his engines were misfiring, he was like unable to steer.
Right. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Although it's a little unclear, because maybe I got confused, but I also thought that he might not also be really good at piloting the ship either.
Well, that could be as well. Yeah.
But in any case, like, he's sort of like just firing engines off beyond Saturn somewhere.
Yeah. I guess the important thing is that he's, like, pretending that it's some sort of, accident, so that nobody knows what's going on.
Well, he's also, he's doing it as an accident. And part of the accident is that he's first using the planet itself, blocking the signal, but then he's also, like, getting out of range.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time, like, because it's something that's important here, because they don't stop trying to hail him. Remember?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it isn't until almost the last part of the movie that they're, oh, we found you finally, you know? So I do think that there is, again, I don't think it's really, I might be forgetting something, but I got the feeling it wasn't really sort of like explained exactly what he was doing, mm-hmm. but overall we're supposed to, you know, take away that he's sort of like pulling a fast one.
Right.
In part because he wants to save the last dome of trees, that everyone else is just nuked. It's like, well, time to go home.
Yeah.
Nuke the trees. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. Like these are like literally the very last, you know, plants from Earth
that they know of. I mean, for all we know, like that's, I think that's one of the things that we should probably emphasize is that, even the person who tells them, like, relays the order to them, mm-hmm. when Lowell asks, you know, like, well, but why, you know, he's like, I don't know. They yeah. have, you know, they didn't tell us anything else. Like, essentially it's like, well, you can blow them up and come home or not come home.
Yeah. Right.
And so maybe they've reconstructed the earth in some way that, I don't know, you got to pay a nickel to smell a flower these days. I don't know. I joke, but like those are a bunch of different little tiny scenarios that I thought about. I was like, well, everything's corporatized, you know, like, like we're supposed to think that the earth is just like walking, you know, walking into Mordor all over the surface of the earth. But at right. the same time, well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just like everything's been enclosed now and everything costs something.
Oh, well, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, the corporations are in charge. So why wouldn't they, you know, like mm-hmm. you can't plant, like imagine the Monsanto Corporation being in charge of your rooftop garden, you know?
Yeah.
that's it. The harvest time is over. You got to buy new seeds next season. Bye.
Exactly.
But yeah, like who knows? And it's not really explained either. So you're supposed to like think like sit with how absurd the order is. Mm-hmm. And sort of like also like I guess if we wanted to be like think about this in the way that I'm going to guess Trumbull was trying is that, you know, like maybe capitalism is absurd, you know, like we wouldn't be like polluting all the rivers. Like this is 72. So this is like heavy into like those anti-pollution campaigns with the Italian guy playing the Indian who cries.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think the point is, and I'm not sure if I think we made this point, but like, it's not that they don't want them to jettison it just so they could go home. That's kind of just like a side thing. They want to do it because they want to fit more cargo, be able to fit more cargo on these ships,
okay.
and generate more profit.
Well, there we go.
So it is like directly like, yeah, it is directly the you know, the death knell, like capitalism, like cutting everything that's not generating a profit.
Well, I mean, I think that this is one of those movies that anyone who thinks that generation ships are going to be the way that we get off the planet mm-hmm. and yeah. save ourselves.
Yeah.
They should probably watch this movie in part because like, so what do you decide is essential for your ecology?
Right.
That you're going to transplant because as I understand it, most everything is essential in the way that it works interconnected with everything else mm-hmm. on this planet. Yeah, like it's the funny thing, the funny observation that I had where it's like, well, I never hear about the two naked mole rats that went aboard Noah's Ark. It's always the big creatures.
That's right.
But anyway, yeah, so I do think that it is somewhat sad, somewhat noble and somewhat sad that, you know, Lowell is just like, he's cracking. Like,
yeah.
By the time he receives that transmission, where it's like breaking up, and they're like, "Oh, we finally found you again. Okay, you know, just be aware. Please repeat. You know, respond to this transmission." And when he does, they tell him, "Oh, you know, you have like about 48 hours before the rescue team arrives. They're gonna, you know, they're gonna." Connect and that'll be it. And he realizes that he needs to make good on his bluff. But you're going to say,
well, exactly. And but in the meantime, the trees are, the plants are dying, and he can't figure out why.
It's sort of almost like, come on, bro, you're like,
well, it's like you're on the dark side of Saturn.
Yeah, and you're like, you know, like a million miles away from the sun. Huh? What do trees need for apart from water and air to survive? Huh? I wonder what that is.
And something the guy says. He says something about like, oh, well, it's dark out there, so you can probably – we can't risk blowing it up with a nuke or something like that, because they went on the jettison the last dome. Mm-hmm. Turns on the light bulb and it makes him realize what the plants have been missing, which, like you said, that it does seem like a little bit of an obvious, like how has that not been a part of like
for who I believe is an ex-forestry service guy.
Yeah.
It seems rather silly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like good thing that weirdly angular GE container had all those light bulbs.
Yes, exactly.
I'm joking. I don't know that's actually the container, but he does have like a bunch of like UV bulbs in storage, and he just sets them up and that sort of like is supposed to be the fix for it. One of the things that happens, I'm trying to remember now, how is it Huey that gets damaged? He's sort of like jetting along on one of the little ATVs. And he doesn't see Huey until the last minute, where he's like just lurches out into the corridor and he just runs him over.
Yeah. And he's damaged pretty bad.
And he tries to fix him, and he does, but like his little extender arm doesn't work, and he apologizes to Dewey, who, you know, sort of like frets a little bit. Silently frets.
Yep.
He apologizes that's the best he can do right now. But that also sets up like this weird end point in the movie, right? Where he then decides, well, you know what? Fuck it. Let's put Dewey in the dome. I've taught him everything. Like, he teaches them how to plant and sort of like be good, do good husbandry for the biodome.
Right.
In a perhaps not fully thought out thing, like the damaged Huey stays with Lowell because he's like, well, you're going to have to do it alone, Dewey, you know, Huey can't really help you anymore. He's too damaged. Which, you know, like if we think about like disability in any way, shape or form, seems like a not so great message there. Like I said, probably just not thought out.
Right.
Yeah. And I therefore think unintentionally insensitive, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Because he knows in 6 hours, I think it was 6 hours or something like that. Like, you know, there's going to be other people there who will see that what's happened. They'll find out that he murdered everybody that they're going to, you know, it's going to all go down. So he makes this final last ditch. He leaves Dewey in the dome. Him and Huey take off.
He jettisons the dome and then like sends it off into space.
And then meanwhile, he himself is holding the nuclear bomb, which goes off and obliterates the Valley Forge and him and Huey. And I think it has just a very poignant final scene, which is just the dome and Dewey inside it going off alone, like, and him, like, you know, with a
Joan Baez song.
Yes. Well, yeah, we didn't even mention there's two Joan Baez songs written specifically for the movie. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're so the, and I think that kind of also lends into this whole, like, kind of like hippie-ish, obviously, mm-hmm. like, you know, folky, crunchy aesthetics by having Joan Baez on the soundtrack.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that is funny to me, Chris, and I don't know if you had the same takeaway, but when we do this very, very cool slow pan out, mm-hmm. From where Lowell is inside the ship. Like, he's got like all his little nuclear detonation devices that he's armed to detonate with Huey by his side. And he's just sort of like, he's got them all lined up, you know, like all six of them in front of him. And it slowly pans out the window, like this bay window that the ship has, where you see the American Airlines symbol, but also a gigantic American flag. And all I could think of, which got me just laughing uproariously to me, to myself, was like, and here's the part of the movie that says death to America, obviously. It is very funny to me because that is it does seem to be saying that, right? Like he's gonna fucking just nuke the entire ship, and the last thing you see is the American Airlines logo and the American flag.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Good thing that Lowell wasn't on one of those 737 spaceships. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't have made it past, you know, Mars. I really like that ending though, of because it has this like kind of like very bittersweet resonance of like, you know, there's no more. Like, humans can no longer enjoy plants, assuming that this is truly the last plants on Earth, right? Mm-hmm. Humans can no longer enjoy it, and yet we're preserved. Like, it's being preserved through the dedication of this one guy, but being maintained through a good perversion of technology. Like, mm-hmm. these guys were made just to be literal drones for capitalism, and Lowell's been able to, you know, change the one and put them to, you know, better ends. That's not just profit driven.
Well, and I would argue that these are very much like in the same vein as, and I wonder if this was an influence on Miyazaki, because it brings to mind the Gardner robots in Laputa, who have been turned from their purpose from being war machines to being cultivators.
Hmm.
Because like the drones, like you said, like, sure, they're working for capitalism, but generally what they're doing is they're working on machinery. Like, mm-hmm. they're the ones that are like doing all the welding and soldering and sort of like just fixing little bits and odds and ends on the outside, like in space, mm-hmm. like on the surface of the outer hull, I should say, mm-hmm. of the ships. So generally what they're used to dealing with is machinery, right? Man-made stuff, because they themselves are man-made, right?
Yep.
I mean, human-made, I suppose, if we're going to be sensitive about it. But what I'm going to say is that, like you said, like, I think that it is interesting that Lowell turns them from that purpose to one of growing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, organic. And they're kind of just like floating off into space all on its own. Now, you know, it's just, I don't know. I find that very poignant in this like very bittersweet, like they're being saved presumably, but like nobody can really, you know, hopefully some, yeah, I don't know. I just really find a lot of nice, like, bittersweet emotions coming out of that last
film. Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't disagree. I would go even further to say that it almost feels like it's one of these things where the question, the unvoiced question in the theme here is, sure, you know, like, capitalism is a machine. Like, it brings to mind, like, that, was it the University of California guy, like the guy that says, like, sometimes you just can't stand it, so you have to put put your bodies on the gears of the machine.
Yes.
And here the question is, well, okay, so you have a robot that is ostensibly, you know, like, quote, quote, immortal, right? Mm. It's a machine. You program it and it will continue doing the thing that you programmed it to do. What if we programmed the machine to do good things?
Right.
Which I will say is very close to, you know, if only we had good people operating the machine, but actually it's slightly different because here he's saying, no, the machine itself, you got to change the machine.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
I don't know.
I was just going to sing Bruce Dern's praises some more. I think he's one of, you know, truly one of our great actors, you know, even among that generation, which, you know, he acted so much with alongside Jack Nicholson and stuff like that. And he, I think he's of that caliber where he plays these kind of like prickly guys so well. And Lowell is definitely prickly. Mm-hmm. And he just does it so, he's just, his performances are just very heartful. He has a very, like, very, very, there's a couple moments where, one where he's having the drones bury the guy who was remaining in the dome that he killed. Mm-hmm. And he's just very, like, you know, it shows, like, he hasn't completely lost any sense of humanity. He's like, you know, it's not like he's like a raving lunatic. He's just somebody who like cares a lot. So, and I think Bruce Dern in particular is in like, you know, really, really just amazing in that scene.
Yeah. I think I think he manages to really walk a fine line. Because like you said, I think that we're supposed to come away with this idea that Lowell is just very passionate, about specifically like nature and ecology and like taking care of nature because, you know, like it has value to him. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, he just doesn't understand how everyone else just doesn't see it.
Right.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Like, he does do a great job of sort of like walking that fine line because it would be very easy to just make that guy a caricature.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. He could have come across as a total lunatic or just like too much of a crunchy granola, you know, guy.
Well, yeah. Like, if he'd been too much of a crunchy granola guy, he would have just like not been able to do anything either.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because he is very pacifist. Effective.
He would have been too pacifist to actually do any direct action type stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, do what needs to be done. But yeah, I think this movie is the rare like sci-fi hangout movie because like so much of the middle is just like him hanging out with his mm-hmm. robot buddies. He, you know, reprograms them to play poker and like it's just so much of it is just kind of just being among, you know, guys and robots being dudes.
And robots, yes.
Yes.
I was gonna say like the there's a long section in the middle where it feels very sort of episodic. Like it's different little mm-hmm. mini adventures that he goes on with his new robot pals, you know.
Yep.
Trying to teach them how to bluff and shit like that.
This movie definitely improved upon reviewing for me or on this viewing for me. I didn't think too highly of it my first viewing, mm-hmm. but on this viewing, I think I really vibed with it a lot more.
It has one of those qualities that I sort of miss in sci-fi movies now, mm-hmm. which is that it's got like these long sections that are just very quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which isn't to say that there isn't anything happening. It's just like minor things. And a lot of these performances are just not, they don't depend on, like, especially in that middle section, don't really depend on dialogue.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. And a lot of it is, and to the extent that there is dialogue, it's just Bruce Dern just like kind of like just talking to these robots who don't talk back. So, yeah.
Well, you know what this, as we've been talking about it, the more and more it brings to mind, like, this feels a lot like that first part of Moon.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like the isolation and like mm-hmm. the different little things that it, that dude does to sort of like keep himself, you know, together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like these long swaths that are just like, just quiet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're right. Yeah. I have to go back to revisit that movie. I really, really enjoyed that movie, but it's been a while.
Like I that was one of those movies where I had, that was where I finally like paid attention to Sam Rockwell.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because I think he does like a really great performance, just subtle differences between like the different versions that are on screen.
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like David Bowie's son has the juice, though, other than that movie.
Sometimes, you know, you just got the one great one, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I will say that I know that we've talked offline a long time ago about Mute and how you didn't like it.
I loathe that movie.
But rare.
I rarely have that reaction to movies.
But you had, I think you had the reaction. Was it because of the shit? What is the name of the actor?
Louis Theroux.
Justin
Theroux.
Louis
is his like distant relative, the British guy who does those documentaries.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I believe that it was his performance that really set you off, which I can understand for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in Mute, they do have a little, reference to Moon. Did you catch it at all?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like it's kind of set in the same universe or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. It that was funny. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I don't think that, Mute compares to Moon. So
no.
And I didn't bother with the World of Warcraft movie because, well,
yeah.
Exactly. It's World of Warcraft. I'm sorry. Yes.
Man, I wish Douglas Trumbull had been able to make more than two movies because we're done his body of directing work at least. And there are two extremely thoughtful, fun science fiction films that like were just were great. Mm-hmm. I wish he did more.
This one doesn't have, I mean, he was able to get Bruce Dern, but like Brainstorm was just had like a great fucking cast too.
Oh yeah. Phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like I don't disagree. It would have been interesting to see what he came up with or if he just cracked and just started doing weird shit. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Either weird in a reactionary form, which could be interesting, or in a more hippie dippy form, which could also be interesting. but in any case, this was my first time watching this one, Chris. Mm. I'd heard lots about it, and I think I just stayed away from it, not for any particular reason. Just simply, I guess I thought I knew what it was about, and I was sort of surprised.
Good,
yeah. It was much more ecologically minded than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like thanks for recommending it.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, do we have anything else?
Watch Silent Running.
Yeah, look, go watch it. Rent it out. It's a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Or not so good time, but it is worthwhile, I think.
Absolutely.
Let's put it that way.
Yes.
It's a fucking huge bummer. but in any case, as the case is right now, that is it. So thanks again, Chris. Everyone, thank you out there for listening in. We'll catch you next time here on Podside. And of course, this wouldn't be the end unless I made another reference. I'm going to push the button, Frank. Bye, everyone.